15.
Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. We were supposed to have Florence High School students with us today, but they were unable to come because there was a blizzard.
A blizzard, yeah.
That part of the state.
Oh, my.
They're going to come some other day.
Oh. In the spring.
All right. In the spring, right. Which is July. Okay. I call our last case for today, 02-2628, McKenzie Fandry versus American Family. Arguing for McKenzie Fandry is James B. Connell, Warsaw. Counsel?
May it please the court, my name is Jim Connell, and I represent McKenzie Fandry. The principal issue in this case is whether public policy considerations can bar a claim based on a legislatively created cause of action. It's our position that public policy considerations cannot be used to bar a claim under Wisconsin's dog bite law.
Ever. Ever?
Ever.
Okay.
My client, McKenzie Fandry, is 6 years old, and when she was three, she was bitten in the face by a dog. The facts, briefly, are that on December 23rd, 2000, she and her mother baked Christmas cookies. And after baking the cookies, the mother and daughter left to deliver them to friends and relatives. They drove to the home of McKenzie's mother's best friend and parked in the driveway. They went to the rear or side door of the home, and McKenzie's mother did what she usually did when she came to the home. She knocked on the door, turned the doorknob, opened the door, and said, "Hello." She got no response. The kitchen table was 3 feet inside the side door, and McKenzie's mother, with McKenzie in her arms, went to the kitchen table, put the cookies down on the table, and then started to write a note. She put the child down, and shortly thereafter heard a scream. The child had been bitten in the face by the homeowner's dog. She commenced an action under Section 174.02, and the action was dismissed on summary judgment. The trial court, citing the public policy factors that are traditionally used in common law claims of negligence. The Court of Appeals certified McKenzie's appeal to determine two issues, and the first issue, as framed by the Court of Appeals, is do the traditional public policy considerations that preclude recovery in tort cases apply to actions under the dog bite statute, or has the legislature, by enacting a strict liability statute, precluded the court from considering these factors because the legislature has declared the state's public policy? Of course, most tort law is judge-made, and in those cases, courts have the duty not only to apply the common law, but to develop and adapt the law to changing conditions. It's this court's duty, for instance, to provide a framework for common law claims, and that may require the court in certain cases to limit liability. The role of the court in claims based upon statutes is different. The meaning of the statute must be found from the language used by the legislature, and courts are not free to determine whether limitations should have been imposed by the legislature.
But why is that?
Because we have two coordinate branches of government with two different jobs. One is the legislature passes laws, and the courts interpret those laws. Now,
so that if a trespasser is in my home, and it applies to everyone, and my dog bites.
Could you speak up, please?
If the trespasser is in my home and the dog bites the trespasser, then he recovers?
Your Honor, Wisconsin has a strict liability law,
and
that law is subject to the principles of comparative negligence.
Mm-hmm.
That's specifically in the law, and also to certain exceptions, some of which applies to trespassers, but not McKenzie-Fondry. Throughout the briefs filed by the respondent in this case, they raise the specter of the hypothetical burglar. I think that hypothetical burglar's case could be handled under the traditional concepts of comparative negligence. Courts can and do, both trial courts and appellate courts, regularly find as a matter of law that a plaintiff is more than 50% responsible for injuries. I would suggest that's the appropriate, that's the standard set by the legislature in these cases.
Mr. Connell, do you think that if we were to take your position that we would have to overrule the Becker case and the Alwyn case?
I think the Becker and Alwyn cases were incorrectly decided. I think the Becker case, of course, did not find that the plaintiff's claim was barred by public policy considerations, but they did consider those considerations. The Alwyn case found that the lady who tripped over a sleeping dog's claim was barred by those public policy considerations. I think that cases obviously can be, the Alwyn case particularly, can be easily distinguished from this case. I think that those two cases should be overruled. That's my position in this case. More than half of the states of the union have dog bite laws, and many of them create strict liability. Several of them have limitations built into the law. I was reading Oklahoma's law, and it says the owner of any dog shall be liable for all damages to the full amount of any damages sustained when the dog, without provocation, bites or injures any person while such person is in or on a place where he or she has a lawful right to be. Wisconsin's legislature could have placed such a restriction on our law, but it has not done so. As a matter of fact, the most recent amendment to the dog bite law suggests that persons on a premises without express invitation are covered by the law. The last amendment to the law, which became effective in the year 2000, created immunity for owners of dogs who injure persons who come onto premises to release other animals. This is a law that is apparently aimed at, I guess, animal rights people who come onto premises like mink farms or research laboratories and release animals. Injuries to those persons from dog bites are expressly excluded from the law. Under familiar rules of statutory construction, where the legislature specifically enumerates certain exceptions to a statute, courts must presume that the legislature intended to exclude other exceptions. I think this is evidence that the legislature did not intend to exclude uninvited persons from the protections of the law. And I think case law supports that as well. There are cases, a case Jansen versus Voss in 1926, the court reversed a judgment because it found that the defendant was not the keeper of the dog, but approved a recovery of a child who wandered into a neighbor's yard and was bitten by a dog tied to a clothesline. And in another case, Tatchell versus Beaker in 1949, a young boy helping his brother deliver papers was awarded damages, although he entered a fenced area in the rear of a yard to deliver the papers.
Also, if I may, I think this case is conceptually difficult. And I think it's conceptually difficult because of my training. Not because of logic, but because of my experience to cite Holmes or something like that. Anyway, it's because of this. We think of common law negligence causes of action. That's what our mindset is in this kind of case oftentimes. And to enhance the confusion, when this statute was amended, it indeed introduced the concept of contributory negligence. So, ha ha, that even makes it smell more like a negligence cause of action. But it's conceptually difficult, I think, because you could have brought a negligence cause of action here. Did you?
No.
And in a negligence cause of action, you would take into consideration things like trespass, right? I mean, I think the law is, in common law negligence, that an owner owes, has a duty, due care to everyone, but not necessarily to trespassers.
I think, although I don't agree with it, that the law would require proof of some willful or intentional intent to injure on the part of a landowner to a trespasser.
That's right. So negligence, when you're talking about a negligence cause of action and trespassing and stuff, you would have more hurdles to get over. You would also, if this were a straight negligence cause of action, would you have any argument at all that public policy, at least potentially, can't come into play to defeat liability?
No.
Okay. But this isn't the negligence cause of action. This is a statutory creation. But negligence is introduced. That's the problem. But is it your position that under the statute, which is public policy, the only thing that has to be shown for liability of the owner is that there was an injury? Is that your position, or is your position
that the dog caused the injury?
That's
correct.
Too cryptically, that the dog, there was an injury and the dog caused the injury.
That's right.
And that's all you have to show for liability.
Yes.
And then, what's, as you're looking at it conceptually, then what happens? You're liable, pay everything.
Contributory negligence can't apply in this case to my client because she's not capable of contributory negligence because of her age.
Mm-hmm.
What the defendant has done in this case, which I think is proper to do and I haven't objected to it, is they brought a third-party claim. And that claim is against the child's mother for failure to properly supervise the child, I think is the basis of the claim.
And that's not a surprise. You would expect that. Your client can't be negligent and you bring in your mother. I mean, I don't know if you're going to go along with it, but that's what I would do too, right?
And if this case goes to a jury, the jury is going to compare. Under the statute, the homeowner's responsibility and the mother's negligence. And that's the framework that the legislature has decided will apply to these strict liability claims under our dog bite law.
The question that I get to is, in looking at the injury by dog special verdict, 1390, the comment and the special verdict as proposed indicate assuming the behavior of, it says parentheses, dog and plaintiff's negligence caused 100% of the plaintiff's injury, what percentage do you attribute to A, dog, B, plaintiff? Is that what you think is the correct
No, I don't think you show the negligence of the dog. I don't think that's what the statute is intended for. I think you would compare the question of the plaintiff's damages, what would be caused by the dog and what would be caused by the negligence of the plaintiff in the ordinary comparative verdict in a case like this. Or in our case, you'd compare the negligence of the mother to the damage caused by the dog. That's the way that's the way I would suggest to the trial court that the verdict be framed. This is not a case of negligence. Ms. Fondre doesn't have to prove any negligence, and the case law is quite clear on that point.
Then I need help. Is the negligence of the dog owner in a statutory action irrelevant?
Yes.
Then what are you comparing? Are you comparing?
You compare the damage caused. That's the way I would compare it. There are case law. As a matter of fact, the strict liability law came into being because of a decision of this court that said that even though the scienter or knowledge of the dog's vicious tendencies has not been the law in this state for 120 years, 30 years ago, the Supreme Court said, but innocent acts of dogs won't be covered by this law. And upon that ruling by this court, the legislature changed the law to make it strict liability, so that any injury caused by a dog is covered by this law.
But not sleeping dogs.
Well, I think you could distinguish this case from the sleeping dog case because I think you could, there are questions of causation there, whether a sleeping dog caused an injury by sleeping. I think you could also handle that case under the comparative negligence principles that we've been talking about as well.
Okay, then I want to follow up because number one, is in any part of the equation under the statutory cause of action, is the dog owner's negligence relevant?
No.
And do you compare at all, this is, I think you've answered the question, but let me be more specific. Do you compare at all the dog owner's negligence with the negligence of the plaintiff?
No.
But do you compare?
I think you have a cause question. What part of the plaintiff's injury was caused by her own negligence in tripping over the dog, or trespassing on some premises, or whatever contribute or provoking a dog or something like that? What part of this damage was caused by the dog? That's the way I conceptualize these claims. That, I think, is part of the strict liability of the statute.
Well, Mr. Spradley, are you finished? I didn't mean to. In ordinary negligence, there's duty, breach, cause. I mean, that's the way we've looked at it since law school. In my case, here you have strict liability. So you worry about the breach, you don't worry about the duty. But in the statute itself, it says the owner of a dog is liable for the full amount of damages caused by the dog injuring or causing the injury to a person. Now here, you're saying you cannot use any policy considerations. Can you use a policy consideration in just the area of cause, forgetting about duty, forgetting about breach?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that the statute is clear and its meaning is unambiguous. If a dog causes an injury, a claim results. I know that those public policy issues in ordinary tort, common law tort actions do address often cause. I think four out of the six policies are basically linkage type of questions. Mm-hmm. But I, in this case, I think it's clear the real harm that this statute addresses is dogs that bite people. And in this case, you can't argue that this child was bitten. The dog caused the injury to the child. That's the way I view it. And I think that's the way the legislature intended that its statute be viewed.
So you think the legislature intended the statute, regardless, the cause is always there, regardless of the circumstances, as I started out to say, a person that is in the home uninvited. It covers all situations.
Yes.
The court cannot intervene.
Yes, and I think that is the reason why the courts created exceptions for some class of trespassers and why comparative negligence is also a part of the strict
liability. But we're not looking at comparative negligence here. We're not looking at negligence. We're just looking at cause.
Yes.
Period.
Yes.
Mr. Connell, I know you've been emphasizing that this is a strict liability action, and I was just thinking we've got strict liability in regard to products liability, and yet public policy considerations can enter in. I know your opponents argue in their brief that safe place law, other situations that would seem to be almost a strict liability situation are still examined with public policy considerations. What makes us different?
Well, I think a couple of things. First, strict liability and products liability and I think public nuisance are the other case cited by the respondents,
right,
are all have their basis in the common law, unlike this case. We have here a statute that I believe is clear, unambiguous, and that the court's role with regard to the statute is to interpret it as it's been written by the legislature. I think I disagree with the safe place analysis made by the respondents in this case. The case they cite does say, have in a footnote, some reference to public policy considerations, but I haven't found a case where those considerations have ever been applied. In fact, safe place cases are the safe place law does is establish a standard of care, and it's referred to as essentially a negligence action, so I think it can be distinguished from this action. I only have a couple of minutes left, and I guess I'll get to the second issue, which is if I'm wrong about the first issue. I believe the second issue, which is framed by the Court of Appeals, says if public policy analysis applies, did the trial court correctly conclude that public policy bars the action in this case? And it's our position that the trial court was wrong in making that finding. Public policy doesn't bar this claim, but I think it supports the claim. Judge Brady relied on three of the six public policy factors in his decision. One, that the injury is wholly out of proportion to the culpability of the negligent tortfeasor. As I've previously indicated, I don't think that policy applies because we're not in a negligence action in this case. Second, the judge found the allowance of recovery would place too unreasonable a burden on the negligent tortfeasor. The burden, I believe, that, again, we're not talking about a negligent tortfeasor, but I think the burden of this statute is a simple one. If you have a dog that bites, you're responsible for it. And I don't think that is too unreasonable a burden to place on dog owners. And the third reason the case was dismissed by the court was allowance of recovery would enter a field that has no sensible or just stopping point. I think we've already addressed the specter of the hypothetical burglar as being the extreme end of these cases. But I think, again, that the legislature has the duty to set the just and reasonable stopping point, and they've done so. They said you can use the comparative negligence statute in evaluating these claims, and we have created exceptions to the claims. I think that this is a case where we have a claim that comes within the public policy of the law, which is to prevent bites, prevent children like this 3-year-old child from being injured. And the policy in this state is if you have a dog that bites, you're responsible for the injury. The old cases from the 1800s said that it's the policy of this state to favor the ownership of sheep and to disfavor the ownership of dogs when they talked about this statute. That may not be valid anymore, but I think the policy of the statute ought to be to favor the interests of a child over the ownership of a dog. I own a dog and I have children, and I can accept the policy that if my dog bites, I'm responsible for that, any injuries that result. And so I think this is a case that comes within the clear intent of the legislature, and that public policy favors McKenzie's claim and should not bar it.
Does the statute establish tort liability?
Well, I think that, yes, I think that strict liability is a species of tort law, yes. Again, what could be done in dog bite cases and frequently is done is you allege two causes of action. You allege negligence and you allege the strict liability. We haven't done so in this case.
What should the owners of this dog have done to prevent this accident?
I don't think that the statute focuses on what the owners can or should do. It focuses on a dog. If you have a dog that bites, you're responsible for it. And I think that is the focus of this law. There is a second part of this claim that when we get to trial about whether the dog bit before and so forth and so on. There's really no dispute about the facts that you have to address in this case. There may be a dispute about whether there's double damages. But in fact, to establish our claim, we only have to prove that the dog bit and that in Wisconsin, if your dog bites someone, you're responsible. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll now hear from John A. Kramer, also of Warsaw, representing American Family Mutual Insurance Company.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is John Kramer. I'm with Zalewski, Klinner & Kramer in Wausau, and I represent American Family Mutual Insurance Company in this case. American Family is the homeowner's insurer of Matthew and Nicole Balunas, who are the dog owners and the homeowners. The essential holding of the trial court in this case was that under these facts, Wisconsin's traditional considerations of public policy applied to prevent liability to Matthew and Nicole Balunas for an injury caused by their dog to a person who was inside their home without their knowledge and without their consent. The court recognized that three of these public policy considerations applied to prevent liability in this case.
Counselor, can I interrupt you just a little bit? I understand from your brief that it's your position that this statute still permits us to apply public policy factors to eliminate the claim, essentially, because when we apply them, we really assume there's liability and we knock the claim out notwithstanding that assumption. If this statute doesn't do it, I have two questions for you. Could the legislature ever write a statute that did do it? And if so, what would it look like? And if it couldn't, why not? I guess that's three questions.
Let me
see what I'm saying?
I think I see what you're saying, and let me try to answer the question.
You're saying they didn't do it here.
They didn't do it in this case. That is our position.
Okay.
And the Court of Appeals recognized that and for 16 years has held that it's not done here and that public policy considerations are a proper inquiry in the strict liability statute.
Okay, but my question goes not to that. It goes to if they didn't do it this statute,
could they have written a statute that would have prevented us from applying public policy factors to it? Could the legislature have said, you got a dog, it bites, that's it? I mean, would they have had to say, courts, you may not adjust this statute?
I haven't thought of the exact wording that can be used, but I think that the legislature could fashion a statute after Becker and after Alwyn in 2000 that would say that this is absolute liability under all circumstances. And I'm trying to come up with the exact terminology that they could use.
Well, wouldn't be absolute liability because they've got two qualifiers in there already. It's much like strict liability for products liability cases where we have contributory negligence as a factor that does get weighed, right, in a common law claim, and we would apply public policy factors to that. My concern is, you know, I've gone over the legislative history, and I can see how it's changed back and forth from saying is, and then there was a maybe, so now you got the dog owner is maybe liable, and then it comes back to put in contributory negligence, and now the dog owner is liable, and there's a change in that. So the legislature is looking at the parameters and the responsibility that we're going to place on dog owners. And if they didn't do it as tightly here as your opponent argues to us that they did, what would they have had to have done with this statute to have done so?
Again, I hearken back to since Becker and since Alwyn, the legislature could
have. But Becker, it was just dicta. They didn't apply it in Becker. They did in Alwyn, I give you that. But they didn't apply it in Becker. They said it's available.
The court could put language in there to say, and no other exceptions will apply, or the courts may not consider considerations of public policy. And I'm sure that there's other language that a legislature can put in, and these people are, I think, in a better position to come up with the language than I can. But I think in view of the way that the statute has been historically applied, that if the legislature wanted to change the language and wanted to make this the only exception, the only qualifying factor being contributory negligence and releasing a dog from a confined enclosure, that there is language that they could put in there to make it that limited.
But you base that basically on your assumption that the legislature read Alwyn, which is it's actually the only case I could find that applies it. And you didn't cite to us Pfeiffer versus Dick where it wasn't applied. But again, I don't think this question was squarely presented in any of the cases, in any of the briefs or the cases I've read. They either apply it or they say it's available or they say they're not going to apply it, but the question hasn't been presented. Can you do it? They just assume they can, or they assume they can't.
I go back to Becker, and I realize what you said about it, you know, being dicta. I think that it is a holding of the court in there. They actually cited the six public policy considerations and actually found that none of them applied in that case and made a finding that the harsh effects or potentially harsh effects of the strict liability in 174.02 could be tempered by three things.
Right.
Made that finding. The legislature had the opportunity. It addressed the statute on four occasions up to 2000. In 2000, Alwyn was decided where these factors were expressly and explicitly applied. No sensible and just stopping point, I believe, was used in the case of the sleeping dog, and they found that liability was precluded on those grounds. I think that there is a real history of this statute being implied and interpreted in this manner by the Court of Appeals. Legislative acquiescence in the interpretation of a legislative enactment is a well-recognized doctrine.
Well, they didn't apply it that way in Pfeiffer versus Dick, which is a 2000 Court of Appeals case. I mean, it was a statutory case, 174.02, and the Court of Appeals says it's not for us to adjust this. The legislature has chosen strict liability.
If I remember Pfeiffer versus Dix correctly, that was the case that followed the Armstrong case that this court decided.
Right.
And Armstrong ruled that when the injured party is a keeper
right. And
the dog owner is the owner,
right. Unless
in that particular instance the dog owner is maintaining control of the animal or is negligent, there's going to be no liability to the keeper.
Right.
And what the defense argued in the Pfeiffer case was, well, this has set down a rule now that says that unless the dog owner is exercising control, there's not going to be strict liability in the statute. And I believe all the Court of Appeals did in the Pfeiffer case was simply said that that's too broad of a reading of the Armstrong decision.
I agree, but they also went on and said this is strict liability and it's not for us to read in or make exceptions. So this question that's before us was not presented to the court there.
I don't believe that it was argued, and I'm not sure that the public policy exceptions were argued in the Pfeiffer case.
No, they're not in the opinion, and I would anticipate they were not argued. That doesn't mean they weren't considered, but they were not argued. But it's still the same statute that we're dealing with here.
That's correct. It's the same statute that's been interpreted since 1987. It's been interpreted as a strict liability statute, but it's also been recognized by the Court of Appeals that there can be these tempering effects of the traditional public policy considerations.
Yeah. What's wrong with just letting a jury decide where the liability ought to rest for this injury? I mean, isn't that what the statute looks to? You've got comparative negligence that's in there, and you have a third-party claim against the mom, and if she shouldn't have been in there, what's wrong with letting the jury sort it out?
The problem with that in this case is the fact that the injury occurred inside the home, inside the house of the dog owner, where they had a right and an expectation that no one was going to come, that no one was going to enter their home when they're away, and there simply was no other place that they should be required in the law to keep their dog.
But what if this injury happened and they were home, and it happened inside their house? You'd have the injury in the same place. Would you still say that it should be barred by public policy?
In that particular case, I would think that there would have to be some express or implied consent. Mackenzie Fondry would not have the legal status of being a trespasser inside their home, and so it would be an entirely different situation. She would be in the house with consent.
I'm not sure. In preparing for this case, I thought it might evolve and maybe does evolve to depend on what is. And take a look at the statute. Now, when we had Becker, that was a different statute. I think that was under 8384, where the statute said may be liable. So, you know, I kind of think, well, Becker, one of the problems we always have to be careful about in law is taking the holding of the case without realizing the statute has changed. So Becker's statute was maybe. This one is. So let's take a look at it. 174.02, subject to contributory negligence, and I'm putting that in rather than the numbers, correct me if you think I'm wrong, subject to contributory negligence, the owner of a dog is liable for the full amount of damages caused by the dog injuring or causing injury to a person, domestic animal, or property. The owner of a dog is liable for full amount of damages caused by the dog injuring. How do you interpret this to be the owner of a dog is liable for the full amount of damages caused by the dog injuring or causing injury unless public policy precludes liability?
I don't read that as language utilized in the statute, but I think if we recognize the statute as a tort cause of action and it's with its enactment with this language essentially in 1981 to fix a problem that there was with the dog's injury statute, holding the dog owner with mischievous or a vicious behavior, a proof problem in that regard. This is a tort statute and a tort cause of action. It's been interpreted.
What do you mean by a tort cause of action? The brief seems to talk about tort in terms of duty and cause. Is that what you mean by tort?
Duty and cause is a concept of negligence. Tort, I think, is broader than that and addresses civil wrongs. But this Court has held, I think within the past decade and within recent years, that other tort causes of action, strict liability for products cases, nuisance cases, whether they be grounded negligent or intentionally caused nuisances, safe place violations under the heightened duty of care, all of those types of cases have had available to temper liability in harsh circumstances these traditional considerations of public policy.
But those causes of action, let me ask, don't those rest on common law negligence?
They rest on common law. Strict liability, for example, was this court's adoption of 402A of the second restatement of torts. The law of nuisance developed in the common law, but we have enactments, rules of law whose violation is going to create civil liability. In this particular, for example, in the strict liability and products case, we have the court that set the standard of care. If you violate these particular elements, prove that the injury is caused by a defective product, there's going to be liability. In this case, what we have is the legislature that's eliminated the proof of negligence or of mischievous or vicious behavior and said that if your dog injures, there's going to be liability. It's really no different. And I think when you're talking about public policy and who sets the policy, I think that there's a distinction between the broad public policy that underpins a legislative enactment or a constitutional mandate, and that public policy in the broad sense, and we can distinguish that from the traditional considerations of public policy that the courts use to temper liability and tort causes of action in harsh or extreme circumstances where this court has said that it would shock the conscience of the court in Pfeiffer.
I see this as a separation of powers case, potentially. Let me ask, if the legislature enacts a statute that, to me, I don't want to use the vernacular, that is not good public policy, but it's constitutional, but the policy and what they've done just stinks to me. Excuse me. What can I do about that?
Well, if I take a look at the Borgnes versus Fault case cited by plaintiff's counsel in his brief and relied upon there, that was exactly the challenge that had been made to the new workers' compensation law back in 1911. They said that it was unconstitutional because it was just bad public policy that the legislature had seen fit to eliminate the defenses of assumption of risk and liability of a fellow servant. And the court said, you know, we're not here to question the public policy underpinning a particular piece of legislation, and they didn't strike it down as unconstitutional. But I think that there's a real distinction. If I was standing here trying to argue that 174.02 was unconstitutional because it was against some public policy, then there might be a policy argument there. Then I might be questioning the broad public policy, but that's not what I'm doing.
Really, I guess maybe inartfully stated. I have in my mind and in my hand the Pfeiffer versus Dix case. It says, moreover, it is not our role to create exceptions to the operation of strict liability. And, of course, this case, Pfeiffer versus Dix, deals specifically with the statute that's before us. And so it isn't just my conjuring up separation of powers. I get that right from this case. It's not our role to create exceptions to the operation of a strict liability statute. In fact, the argument very much in Pfeiffer and Dix, referring to the Armstrong case, is, look, we've got here a defendant who wasn't exercising control over the dog, really isn't negligent, therefore the argument was, shouldn't be liable under 174.02 for the injuries incurred by a third person. And the Court of Appeals says, look at the statute. We start with the words of the statute. And our role isn't to change the policy. Now I'm adding words. Our role is not to change the policy of the legislature. You know, it's the exact words. It's not our role to create exceptions to the operation of a strict liability statute by implication. And it seems to me that's what we're asking here. Tell me why you're not asking that, because I have real problems with that.
Pfeiffer was addressing, and I hesitate to use the word exception, but in essence an exception that was created by this court in the Armstrong case.
An owner can't sue an owner. Keeper is an owner, and owner is not owner.
If you take a look at the Armstrong decision, if you strictly apply the very language of the statute in Armstrong, you have to come away with at least the initial impression that there's going to be liability for the dog owner. But this court said in Armstrong that we can't read the statute to mean that one owner can sue another owner. Armstrong very easily can be read as simply a public policy consideration.
I don't think so, Counselor. It's specifically based on the definitions contained within the statute, Section 175.001, sub 5, sub parent, and 174.021A. I mean, that's how Armstrong got where it got. And I don't think it's a public policy case. It's a case where this Court interpreted two statutes and had to read them in combination with each other and come up with what they thought the legislature had in mind.
It did never use the term public policy. I don't mean to imply that the court made the holding there, but it can be, it could be viewed in that way, that this is another way we could have reached that same result. I don't know whether public policy considerations were argued in the Pfeiffer case. Pfeiffer just dealt with trying to apply further that rule set up in the Armstrong case, and the Court of Appeals, as I read it, simply pulled that in. But, you know, in the Becker case, the court also talked about the strict liability language set forth in 174.02 and talked about the fact that it was a statutory enactment and they couldn't add anything. And they said, plus any harsh results that would apply can be tempered by these tort considerations. It mentioned causation, comparative negligence, and again, the public policy considerations.
Right, but see, that's when the statute said may be liable, the owner may be liable. That's the statute Becker interpreted. So it wasn't a strict liability statute at that point in time. And my problem is much like Justice Bradley's. I'm very sympathetic with what you're arguing, and you do it well. I don't mean to pick on you. But I have a problem with our being asked to enter a public policy analysis, which is what we would do if we buy your argument, that could give us a contrary result to the legislature's public policy analysis. And they went back and forth on whether the owner is liable, may liable. If he is liable, what are the specific limitations? And that bothers me a lot, to be thinking that we should be in that position when it seems that's what they did.
I want to attempt to address your concern about the statute that was in place when Becker was decided. The injury in the Becker case took place while the 1983 statute was in place.
Right.
1981 changed it to the is liable language. Mm-hmm. And if we put it in context, trial courts were starting to not believe that they could apply contributory negligence, so the legislature changed it to may be liable. And the argument made, if I remember correctly, in Becker was that one of the parties suggested that that change to may be liable returned us back to the common law negligence standard. And what the court in Becker said was, no, that's not the case. This is still strict liability, but may be liable simply lets us know that we can apply contributory negligence, that that's still good law. And if we need further proof of that, the court said, there's the 1985 enactment that leaves no doubt that we can still consider contributory negligence.
Which
puts it back in. So I think the Becker decision very much was a strict liability decision because they found an ambiguity under the may be liable language, but nonetheless interpreted it to be a strict liability statute. And I think that there was a concern being addressed at that point when contributory negligence was specifically put back into the statute. But I don't think that that affects the overall history of this law and the fact that it's still a court cause of action that's been treated as such throughout its entire creation up through Hansen in 1960 and Chambliss in the 1970s, and then now from 1987 forward with Becker, and is correctly applied in Alwyn. And I think the legislature, by its silence in not addressing this issue, has given its consent and its acquiescence that this is a correct interpretation of 174.02, that public policy considerations can be considered as a tempering effect for what might be harsh liability under that statute. And it makes really good sense in this particular case where you have an individual that's trespassing into the home of other people. Yes, Mackenzie Fondry was only 3 years old at the time, but the law of trespass in Wisconsin says that it's the status of the party, and it doesn't matter what their intent is in becoming trespassers on the premises.
Can you name for me any other statutory claim for relief where this court has ever applied public policy factors to preclude the claim?
I can tell you that the court has addressed itself to the statutory heightened duty in the Safe Place statute, and at least in the footnote in the case I cited in my brief has mentioned that public policy would be available to temper the liability under the Safe Place statute. But I have looked for other statutory enactments that we can analogize to the strict liability under 174.02, and this is a pretty unique statute. And I think that uniqueness comes from some historical proof problems in the common law, and the legislature has, I think, simply eliminated the proof problem of proving negligence, but left the rest of the tort cause of action intact, using the term causation, which is a negligence and a tort terminology, by telling the courts that they can still apply comparative negligence and contributory negligence, and by acquiescing in the Court of Appeals' interpretation of that statute and allowing public policy considerations to be used.
Mr. Kramer, let's assume for a minute that public policy considerations are appropriate. Do you agree with the three reasons applied, the three factors applied by the circuit judge in this case, or do you think that one is stronger than the other, or would you add some additional factors?
I agree with all three of the factors set up by the trial court in this case. And when applying public policy factors, it only matters that one of them be present to preclude liability. But as I look at this case, I think that the strongest of the policy factors, when considering the fact that Mackenzie Fondry was inside their home without express or implied consent, the strongest of these is that recovery in this case would place too unreasonable burden on the dog owner. And that is because the Balloonus's dog in this case was exactly where that dog should have been when they went to the movies that afternoon. There is no other place that they can reasonably have been expected to keep that dog. And if we're not going to apply public policy to limit liability in this particular case, we're placing a tremendous burden on dog owners and homeowners. We're going to require them to do something else on the off chance that somebody is going to wander or walk into their home, the sanctity of their house, uninvited and without their consent. And if they get injured by the dog, they're going to get sued. Are we going to require them to put their dog in a kennel every time they go to the grocery store or to leave the dog in the car?
Lock the door.
Pardon me?
Why don't they just lock the door?
I don't think that we should be in a position, respectfully, to require homeowners to lock the door. It's commonplace for people not to lock their doors. I know of a lot of people, unfortunately, up in my neck of the woods that don't do it. But I don't believe that we should place that as a burden on people, that they have to lock their doors because somebody is going to enter their premises. The key is that you're gaining access or entering their property without their permission. So whether they have their door locked, to me, is completely irrelevant, because they could break the window or go in through a loose window or jimmy a door. There's lots of ways to gain access, and I don't think the fact that the door was not locked in this particular instance is legally relevant.
One of my concerns is there aren't a lot of statutes that the legislature says, boy, we really are concerned about this, you know? We're Wisconsin, so one of the things we're concerned about is you come on my land and cut my trees. If I recall, maybe that's changed, but when I was practicing law, anyone do that, there was a strict liability, and you get double damages. Tim, coming and cutting my trees, you get double damages, whether you meant to cut them or not. Again, I'm not sure that's still the law, but that's the way I recall the law. I had a case regarding that. And it seems to me this is another one. The legislature is saying, hey, I mean, we feel so strongly about this, we're going to do, if there's notice, double damages. And there's just so few, you know, I'm surprised we don't have one if you steal my cow, you know, it'd be quadruple damages in Wisconsin. But there are so few things that the legislature says, and I really mean it, and I mean this so much, that we're going to enhance the penalty. So I sit up and take note that the legislature has enacted a specific statute. The words say what they say. You can maybe disagree what they say, but this is the policy that they have enunciated. Let's say, hypothetically, there's a statute that says if you steal, not steal, I'm not talking about intentional, I'm talking about you come on my land and you cut my trees, that you're going to be liable, this is hypothetical, for double the damages. Now, if the legislature did impose that or enact that, you're saying the courts could say, well, you know, he really didn't mean it, and it was a little old lady in a wheelchair, and so we're going to say it would place an undue burden, because the only reason she cut down that, she thought it was her property, on her property, and she only did it for, you know, food for her starving kids or something. Now what I'm trying to do is, you know, get some sympathy in there, but are we able to, as a court, say public policy precludes that hypothetical enactment for liability and double damages?
I guess I would have to know more about that legislative enactment and the history and the development of tree cutting law and the reasons for that particular statute and the language of the statute before I can really answer that question directly. If it was all similar to this particular law,
is liable for
damages caused by. But what I'm saying is, if it had the history behind it, if it was viewed and historically held to be a tort cause of action, if there was other case law in place that had interpreted public policy considerations to apply, I would say that you could make the analysis. Now, I'm not sure under your facts that those public policy considerations would support a limitation of liability. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think that you probably could do it, but I would have to know more about the specific piece of legislation, the history behind it, and things like that. I think you can apply public policy considerations, traditional public policy considerations of the court, to limit liability in those really harsh or really unjust cases without chipping away or eroding the broad public policy pronouncement that the legislature gives when it enacts a statute.
I mean, I don't want to hurt your opposing counsel's feelings, but I think if this case goes to trial, you have a good chance of prevailing with regard to your third-party cause of action. I mean, isn't that where the amelioration comes in, that the mother tagged with some negligence in your third-party action?
I would like to think that I could do that if I had to try this case, but I can tell you that if the jury found that there was 10% responsibility on the balloonesses for being the dog owners in this situation, or if there was 1% responsibility in this situation, because this injury happened to somebody who was trespassing, who was in their home without a privilege to be there, that 1% would be unjust. And it doesn't matter about my third-party claim against Mrs. Rausch. Okay. What we're concerned with is liability to Mackenzie Fondry in the first instance, and I think it's completely appropriate for something such as a trespass, or in this particular case, a trespass inside a dwelling, to be properly considered as a limiting public policy consideration, and that there should be no liability in the first instance. Thank you.
Could I ask?
Oh, I'm sorry.
In a first-degree murder case, a defendant can still have some defenses, privilege, self-defense, necessity, coercion? Do dogs ever have a defense?
I would certainly hope that dogs would have defenses. And let me answer your question this way. And that's by saying, what if we don't allow considerations of public policy to temper liability? In that situation, Mrs. Alwyn, who tripped over a sleeping dog, would be able to collect from the dog owner. And that, to me, is an unconscionable and unjust result. We had a situation in my office where a child who was too young to be contributory negligent impaled a dog with a sharp object and got bit during the process of it. There ought to be no liability in a situation like that, but you can't consider contributory negligence. It would seem to me that public policy considerations would have to properly be applied, and really, as a matter of good sense and in the history of our tort law, should be applied in those certain exceptions where there's going to be an unjust result or where it's going to shock the conscience of the court to impose liability. So the simple answer to your question, I believe, is yes, there should be some defenses that the court can examine on a case-by-case basis within the framework of our tort law as it's developed in Wisconsin.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel. Mr. Connell, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Recently, this court in Stevenson versus Universal Metrics applied public policy factors to bar a claim against a designated driver who failed to do the job. And in applying those factors, the court noted that since territorial days, the legislature has been extensively involved in the decision of whom to hold accountable for the negligent actions of inebriated persons. Given that history and the current state of the law, the court said it was reluctant to create liability where the legislature has not expressed that there should be any. I think this case presents the other side of the coin. Here we deal with a law that in one form or another has been the law of this state since 1852. It's clear that the legislature has been extensively involved in the decision of whom to hold accountable for injuries caused by dogs. Given that history and the current statute, this court should reject attempts to limit liability where the legislature has not expressly provided. I've read that there's 4.7 million dog bites every year. This court has had the occasion to deal criminally with the owners of dogs who bite. Children are unfortunately often the victims of dog bites. I don't believe that it's an unreasonable burden on the owners of dogs to be responsible for dog bites. I own a dog, and I know many other dog owners, and I just don't believe that they would feel that to be an unreasonable burden. Mr. Kramer talked about legislative acquiescence in the Alwyn and Becker decisions. I don't believe there's any legislative history that would evidence that the legislature ever considered the Becker or Alwyn decisions in their recent amendments. The issue in this case was not raised nor decided in Becker and Alwyn. That Alwyn case arose out of Wausau, too, and I got the lawyers down the block to bring me all their briefs, and there isn't a mention in any of them or in the Court of Appeals decision about whether public policies should or should not be engrafted upon our dog bite statute. And finally, I think if we're talking about rules of statutory construction, the one that I mentioned earlier about the specific exceptions is a stronger rule of statutory construction. I'd say it in Latin, but I haven't been in class for a long time, but it's expressio unius, et cetera. That rule of statutory construction and the recent amendments to the statutes, I think, are a stronger rule than the rule of legislative acquiescence.
Does this case really present a question of statutory interpretation, though, or a question about imposition of tort liability on a broader, in a broader sense?
I think that I've always viewed this case as the court's role in this case is interpreting the statute. What does this statute mean? And I think it's going beyond the role of the court to interpret this statute to permit these exceptions that the legislature has not enacted.
I don't view this case as presenting a statutory interpretation question. The question that was certified was whether common law public policy limitations on liability in tort are applicable to a statutory liability or claims such as this.
Sure.
And tort liability can arise by virtue of violations of all kinds of social duties. That's what tort liability is. It's a civil wrong that arises because of a violation of a social duty as opposed to a contractual duty that has been bargained for, right?
Yes.
Okay. Those social duties are imposed by courts at common law, but also by the legislature. But it's still tort liability. And the courts are always the gatekeepers on that. I assume that you would probably disagree with that. But that's the question that I think this case fundamentally presents. Not a question of statutory interpretation. The statute is plain on its face. We don't have an argument that it's ambiguous. The question is more fundamentally whether public policy limitations on liability at common law can preclude liability where the duty arises by way of statute.
Well, I agree, but I think the point where you start to make a determination of whether there should be these considerations of public policy is by looking at the statute first. And I think the statute in this case, when it says the dog owner is liable for injuries caused by the dog, sets the policy. The policy is if you have a dog that bites, you're responsible for the damages.
But once the legislature moves into a tort area, then the legislature, you look to see if they intended to occupy that area or whether they still left the court with room to maneuver.
I think you're right, and that's why I cited the reasoning in the Stevenson case. For 150 years, the legislature has occupied this area of dog bite or dog owner liability. They've changed and amended and so forth the statute on frequent occasions. And
hasn't it really been more of a dance between the legislature and this court, just like in the alcohol liability field that Stevenson referenced?
Sure. I think it is, but I think that dance shows the legislator's intent to occupy this field and to make the rules regarding the liability of dog owners.
The rules of the dance set by the legislature, you say, and then that's why you want to look at legislative intent. I mean, that's your position.
That's correct,
Your Honor. Whether the court adopts it or not is another issue.
Yes.
May I ask one other question, Mr. Connell? The statute applies not only to dog bites to people. It applies to dog bites to other dogs.
It applies, those of us who practice in the field always refer to it as the dog bite law, but it's broader than that. It's a dog, it's for injuries caused by dogs. And as I said, I think that the older cases say that the original intent was to protect sheep that we passed this law. I think the recent interpretations of this law are that the law exists for the protection of persons just like my little client, a child.
But if I were Justice Bradley's dog,
you would be a fortunate.
You'd be outside all the time.
I'll tell you, Max has a good life.
If I were Justice Bradley's dog, and you were another dog, and you bit me, and I bit you back worse, she could be liable. Is that right?
Yes. I don't know. I guess I maybe it's my own personal feelings about dogs, but I don't think dogs ought to bite. And I think that it's a perfectly reasonable burden to put on the owner of a dog. If your dog bites, you're responsible for the damage. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Connell, and thank you, Mr. Kramer, for your argument in yet another dog bite case that has come to this board. And then it concludes our hearing in 02-2628, Mackenzie Fan versus American Family. The court's in recess until 9:45 tomorrow morning. That was the dog. That's right. Lightning. Okay.
Have a safe drive back.
Thank you.
I did this, I did it wrong.
Uh-oh. Here she is.
Go gallivant. I said you were gallivanting. Gallivanting around the castle. Just as so.
Okay, where did my son look like?
So she just wants to turn it on. Okay, all right. Should I shut it?
And then, yeah.
Shut it down.
Thank you.
Everything's so crystal clear out here. And the team is going to tell you my one anti-smoking message.
Oh, there she is.
Okay, well then you both can hear.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I thought it was with the TV or the radio, but then Jack was saying it's with...
new acoustics?
Yeah.
They're testing. New acoustics?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay, now I...
What we have to do is we have to unplug there.
I told Patty that I'm going to tell you guys my one anti-smoking message for the day.
That's a great idea. I want to...
Okay, my dad got lung cancer and died. Okay, I know that that's not that far away for some people.
Yes, Mother.
I know, I'm sorry.
No,
it's really not nice.
No.
There you go, have a computer.
All right, now get out of my hearing. I'm sorry, slash.
That's
my
face.
That's my face.
Oh, it is not.
Thank you.